So,
what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
It's Friday, that's right, the weekend's here, and we have had an action-packed week here on Trending, and we're taking it off with a bang here to end the week. Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire, known for his show, The Michael Knowles Show, will be joining me in just a little bit here on Trending, and we'll discuss Kanye West, his take on Kanye West, as Kanye continues to stay in the media's eye with everything from politics, albums, conversion to Christianity, talking about premarital sex, you name it. He just continues to trend on social media. So I'm interested to hear Michael Knowles' take. We'll also talk about the Daily Wire's move to Nashville. That's right, Nashville, Tennessee from California. Ooh, that's a big one. And also, we'll talk about friendships and maintaining friendships in the face of a culture of compelled speech and censorship. So stay tuned. Michael Knowles will be joining me in just a little bit. Okay, for pop takes today, as we close out the week, there are two things I want to talk about. One, everyone's heart is throbbing, Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt's reunion. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. If you haven't caught them yet, I'm posting the videos on Twitter, but we'll also play some audio here in a second. But I want to first talk about a very shocking trend that is occurring internationally, and that's that since COVID-19's quarantine has kicked in March and in some areas continues to be pretty intense, especially us poor Californians here, there has been an increase in stillbirths. That's right, women who are pregnant would be giving birth to their children. In fact, even in Nepal, physicians have noted a 50% increase in stillbirths compared to pre-COVID numbers. Now, in research they're doing, it has nothing to do with a child having contracted COVID nor the mother, but there's a lot of question about, are women who are pregnant receiving adequate care? This is a real question. And I think that it's interesting because I think it's easy to be kind of negligible about developing human life. I had a dear friend who recently had a high-risk pregnancy and gave birth just a few weeks ago to twins. And I was astonished by the negligence of her care providers through the course of her pregnancy. Why is it that we so easily devalue human life and are so quick to help those who are in need because of COVID? For example, it's not just women who are pregnant and have babies in utero, but also the elderly who have not had access to basic care they need to care for their various ailments that come with age and disease. But I'm also wondering if there might be some link to do-it-yourself abortions, possibly. Or is it just hopelessness and fear has such a negative impact on a woman when she's pregnant that it's leading to these stillbirths? Is it anxiety? Or is even the fact that we as humans haven't even been moving enough with this whole stay-at-home order written in all caps on just about every street sign, at least here up and down the state of California, for months now? What are we doing to the human person? Are we seeing the degeneration of the human person out of anxiety, fear, lack of movement, lack of proper nutrition, and lack of social engagement? I think that this is one of the consequences that we see from an ongoing, quote, social distancing that is really quite harmful for individual people. So I bring this up to challenge you to find ways to stay connected with other people, to find ways to be full of hope and to let go of that fear and anxiety, to stay physically active and move around. You know, we're a body and a soul, and we have to work on the mental dimension of what we may be going through with COVID, but also on the physical dimension of these changed circumstances. On to the Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt reunion. Is anyone else's heart just absolutely throbbing and breaking as you've seen this? They both participated in a virtual comedy table reading yesterday, and they are just taking social media by storm today. They're trending number one most of the day, at least on Twitter. And I'm wondering this, why has this reunion pulled at the heartstrings of so many people? In fact, even when you watch the video of Brad and Jen first saying hello to each other with all of these other actors and actresses on the video screen, their reaction is fascinating. They're all smiling. I was talking to my mom, she said they're jonesing in that video. The actors and actresses themselves are hungry for some Brad and Jen again. Listen to this. This is when they first greet each other on the video.
Aniston.
Hi, Pitt.
How you doing?
Good, honey. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right.
There was definitely some hair twirling, some smiling, a lot going on in those moments. They may be actors and actresses, but there was still some chemistry. But why is it that we are having the public reaction we are having? You see, I think that deep down inside, no matter what actions we may take with regard to kind of degrading marriage in the culture, not getting married, not being fans of having a family, settling down, at the same point, there's something we want to see in our heroes. There's something we want to see in those people we admire and follow. We want to see permanence in their marriages. We want to see fidelity. We want to see happy endings. We want to see those faithful relationships and those people we follow and admire the most. It's pretty fascinating that all these years later, people still want Brad and Jen. But this also brings up another question. And I was written to this week on Instagram about it. And here's my question I threw out there. What happens when we want more in terms of a true relationship with someone who is essentially an avatar to us? It might be an actor and an actress like Brad or Jen. It might even be someone in the Catholic world who you just love following, you know, every detail about their life. What happens when we want more from those relationships? So one listener wrote to me on Instagram this week, said she recently sought out the advice via social media of someone she's followed for years. She actually knew them as a teenager at church, but this person knows nothing about them and their life. And she was rather embarrassed when she realized this. They had no idea who she was. And then she realized that it just kind of seemed somewhat creepy and random and odd asking for advice. And she said she realized it was the opposite of a healthy social interaction and left her feeling rather separated from this person, but kind of almost contributing to this emotional feeling of like, I actually am even more alone after having reached out to this person than I was when I first sought their advice. Yet she had spent all this time following and knowing every detail of this individual person. And I thought it was really fascinating when she wrote to me, because I think that this is the challenge we have now. What happens when we want more in terms of a true relationship with someone who really is just an avatar to us? Sure, maybe you've developed friendships on social media and you've exchanged a few comments back and forth. But then, and it might even be an extended family member or a friend from years ago, but then you meet up in person and just the chemistry and the interaction isn't there, yet you know all the nitty-gritty details about them. That's in a really personal way, a step closer. But then get into the celebrity lifestyles. Get into people we admire, all these public figures. And isn't it interesting? We want more from them, even though we know we're just following an avatar. Someone who is not personal or personable with us. And look how alone that can make us feel. What I was thinking was that we really have to be careful not to idolize someone or a relationship. Because even at the same time, we could even fall down the rabbit hole of trying to develop a real relationship with someone just by following them on social media. And spending hours just continuously looking at their feed, looking at their kids' photos, looking at their dating relationships, looking at the things they wear. Yet the whole time what we were craving was an authentic relationship with that person. Yet we spent hours, perhaps even weeks, just scrolling social media, searching. Instead, I challenge you to take time to cultivate your mind. Because what triggered this whole conversation was the fact that she was looking for advice. Perhaps we need to cultivate our mind with the things we're reading, the things we're learning, with our prayer life, developing that prayer life with our Lord Jesus Christ and His Blessed Mother, asking her intercession. Or we could also discuss working on developing relationships with people in real life. Or perhaps you have a loved one. I have to tell you, I have loved ones who live far away, friends I've met over the years who we just have this awesome chemistry and connection, but we don't get to see each other very often. And so picking up the phone and spending that time talking, which I know is probably more common for girls than you dudes, we can do that and actually have those real relationships. Get away from the texting and social media. Again, mindfulness, developing that prayer life, developing the intellectual life, and developing those relationships will help lessen the loneliness we're feeling that social media has really, truly been fueling. My guest today is Michael Knowles here on Trending with Timmery. You've heard him on The Daily Wire with his show, The Michael Knowles Show. And I know everyone's asking the question, why Nashville and are you going to? So we'll get to that in just a little bit. Michael, welcome to the show.
Always great to be with you, Timmery. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have a fellow Californian, well, not originally Californian, here chatting via the airwaves here. So tell me, are you going to Nashville?
Yeehaw. That's all I can say. Howdy do. Yes, I am going to Nashville. I don't know if just the news picked up on it or if he even announced it, but the news broke in any case last week. And I'm looking forward to doing it. It was funny. When it was announced, I happened to be with Senator Cruz because we were doing this podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz. And he just looked straight down at his phone, pulled up George Strait and said, all my exes are in Texas. So I hang my hat in Tennessee. And so the reason we're going is, well, one, Nashville's a great town, but we're really leaving. We're leaving L.A. because California has made it virtually impossible to do business of any sort, and certainly as a conservative. The tax regime is punitive at this point, and they're about to hike it even more intensely. The regulations are an extraordinary burden. They've been considering a wealth tax that I think may even be unconstitutional. They're looking at a reparations bill for slavery, which is very ironic because California, for those who don't remember, was a free state. It was actually, mm-hmm. The admission of California into the Union was one of the causes of the Civil War because they did not condone slavery here. But this reparations bill isn't even asking whether or not to create some kind of reparations regime. It's simply asking how much and to whom. So and this is on top, of course, of the spiking homelessness in Los Angeles. $1.2 billion mm-hmm. bond was passed mm-hmm. a few years ago. Homelessness spiked 16% in just 1 year in the city. They didn't do anything with the money other than squander it. Crime, obviously, through the roof. Stores boarded up. I love California as much as the next guy, but I have to say bad governance has left it in a pretty bleak picture. And so a lot of us, Elon Musk, Joe Rogan, and now all of us here at The Daily Wire, we are saying farewell to the West for now, and hopefully we can come back when it's a little bit saner.
Wow, here is another coronavirus casualty forcing people out. And it's fascinating because I live in San Diego and we have people from LA moving down here. And I'm saying, okay, San Diego isn't that much better, but the homelessness issue alone, and it's making the streets unsafe as well as with the issue of these protests and riots not being kept under control in any way whatsoever. It's just absolute anarchy in many of the Western states right now.
That's right. A friend of mine, actually a colleague too, young Catholic
Ooh, I think we lost you for a second there. Are you back, Michael? Ooh, we'll get him back connected to us. We're going to get Michael's take in just a moment here on Kanye West. We're working on reconnecting with him. You know, it's fascinating to me because last summer, I have to tell you, I am not an LA person. I'll start by saying that. The few times a year, hopefully maybe only once a year, I have to go to LA. It is an in and out trip, and I try to stay right where I have to be. I'm not a fan. The traffic is awful. The billboards are horrendous. The homelessness is unreal. And it just feels unsafe on the streets. Last time I was there, last summer, there were needles all over the ground, multiple homeless little shelters, and I had to park a million miles away from the location I needed to be for filming. And I'm like walking down these scary streets trying to call friends and family, sharing my location, because it literally just feels unsafe, unstable, unregulated in any way whatsoever. If you're not here in Southern California, not only are people leaving in droves from Los Angeles, but they're actually offering for the first time in LA, you know, incentives to move in. It used to be to try and get a flat in LA, you were paying astronomical amount of money. Now they are trying to do everything they can to get people to move into apartments and to get him try to get people to move here, to stay here, but people don't want to. They're saying, no, thank you. Michael Knowles is back with us, and he was sharing a story about a young Catholic friend. Ooh, I don't think we've quite got him back. We're having some audio issues here. Listen, I want to talk a little bit about Kanye West. So Kanye West continues to be in the news with everything from his massive conversion into Christianity. He has this new moral outlook on life, and now he's dabbling in politics. He continues to be a trend on social media over and over again. It's fascinating some of the things that come out of this guy's mouth. One of which being when he was working on his most recent album, Kanye was actually asking all those people behind the scenes who are working on his album, which Kanye West is a rap sensation, right? Kanye West is asking his crew to stop engaging in premarital sex. He literally asked his staff to stop having sex outside of marriage. This is someone who's been in the rap world for years. This is someone who himself admits he struggled with pornography, who we've seen live on Keeping Up with the Kardashians as him and Kim Kardashian throw it down over modesty as he's suddenly gone through this conversion this last year, and now he wants her to dress more modestly. I've actually had a lot of respect for how Kim has handled these situations. It's quite fascinating. We've covered it here on the show before, but I believe Michael Knowles is back. And Michael, I want to get your take on Kanye West, his conversion, some of the things he's asking of his staff members. What's your first reaction?
I love it. I could not put it any more simply than that. I absolutely love it. You know, God uses the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. And I think this is an example of that, because Kanye West has had an eccentric career, to say the least. He's certainly taken some bad routes there. And he's had this conversion experience. And he's saying things now that are perfectly rational, except in our irrational culture, people are now calling him crazy. I find it so ironic that for most of Kanye's career, he's done all sorts of crazy things. He interrupts people during the Grammys. He dances around singing vulgar things in crazy costumes. There, everybody remains silent. But the moment he says, perhaps we shouldn't kill unborn babies, they say he's having a mental breakdown and needs to be institutionalized. Frankly, I think that Kanye West is more conservative than about 70 or 80% of Republicans. I think he's really tapping into something that is at the heart of our civilization. And I know how funny, I know how ironic that sounds, but he's viewing politics now through a lens not merely of economics or tax cuts, all of which is well and good, but through a lens of culture, and then ultimately the root of that culture, which is religion. It's all coming back to God, and a culture a politics that is continually incentivizing people to be in a state of grave mortal sin. It can never be a virtuous, self-governing society. The founders of our country knew that, and it seems that we've forgotten it, and it takes an eccentric rapper to remind us of that. And I think that's just wonderful.
That's Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire here on Trending with Timmery. I want to play this audio clip that we all heard last year, right around this time, October of 2019, as Kanye West told Apple Music Zane Lowe that he's letting people know what Jesus has done for him. And I have to say, I really admire something about this. Listen to the clip and I'll tell you what.
Now that I'm in service to Christ, my job is to spread the gospel. To let people know what Jesus has done for me. You know, I've spread it a lot of things. There was a time I was letting you know what high fashion had done for me. I was letting you know what the Hennessy had done for me. I was letting you know all these things. But now I'm letting you know what Jesus has done for me. And in that, I'm no longer a slave. I'm a son now, a son of God. I'm free.
I'd really like to count the number of times that he has been trending on Twitter and social media because, Michael, he continues to say something that is so profound. People get worked up. They try to call him a lunatic. But here's what stood out in that clip to me last year, and I want to bring it up again now with you. He promotes essentially what influences him the most. He mentions that about high fashion, how he incorporates it into his music. And now it's our Lord Jesus Christ, and he is preaching it from the rooftops. Do you think this is authentic?
I do think it's authentic. I mean, I see no evidence that he's being cynical about this. It's actually cost him a fair bit in his career to give this kind of witness, and it was very risky from the beginning. So I don't see any evidence of a cynical motive here. Also, what I see, and I think this is why people don't really understand it, is that Kanye West has intuited something about culture and specifically politics that everyone in this country on both sides of the aisle has forgotten. We are now under the spell of this idea of human nature, that man is born free and that he becomes a slave because he has duties and responsibilities. And that's what makes him a slave. And if only we got rid of all of our duties and responsibilities and restraints, then we would be free. And the reality is exactly the opposite. The Christian understanding of freedom, of liberty, the classical understanding of freedom and liberty, actually even pre-Christian, is that we are not born free in the sense of controlling ourselves, that actually we're born little slaves. Babies can't do very much for themselves. And toddlers, as the parents in the audience know, are absolute terrors. They follow their passions and their appetites, and they'll eat every last cookie if they can, even if they get a stomach ache. And what we need to do is be educated in what were once called the liberal arts and the arts of our freedom, so that we can practice the virtues, so that we can come to an understanding of our own freedom and that we can exercise it. That to use Christ's words, the man who sins is a slave to sin. Even if we've got all the political freedom in the world, you know, even Lord Acton, who's always invoked by the libertarians, he said that liberty is not the freedom to do what we please, but the freedom to do what we ought. And so now we have the sense today that freedom is being able to do a lot of drugs and sleep with whoever you want and abuse yourself however you want. That's the opposite. That's actually slavery. And a culture that indulges that definition of liberty is a culture in slavery. Kanye West understands where freedom comes from.
That's Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire. We'll be coming right back and we'll be asking him the question, how do you prioritize your faith over politics? We'll be right back here on Trending.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
If you don't know by now, Michael Knowles is Catholic. He's in the political sphere. He's with the Daily Wire and has the show, the Michael Knowles Show, and he really does wear his Catholicism on his sleeve. A faithful Catholic. So my question, Michael, is how do you prioritize your faith over politics?
It's a good question because I know sometimes people try to play it closer to the vest and they're a little less flamboyant, perhaps, about their religious views. for me, I suppose, it's all of a piece. The politics, the culture, the religion. It's all of a piece. And I think one of the great errors of modern politics is that we try to compartmentalize and divvy society up, and even at the sort of hyper-individualistic level, to pretend that these things don't have to do with one another. But as Andrew Breitbart, the great patron saint of Hollywood conservatives, famously pointed out, politics is downstream of culture. And we know that culture is downstream mm-hmm. of religion. Culture and cult come from the same root word, to cultivate. You know, what the culture worships will define that culture. And so it's all of a piece. You can't have a politics that's totally disconnected from your religion. The phrase separation of church and state is one of the most misunderstood and abused phrases in our entire culture, because first of all, there has never been a state in history that is divorced from religious considerations. Sometimes you'll hear this silly phrase, we can't legislate morality. But of course, all laws legislate morality. All laws derive ultimately from the moral law. I mean, even if you're making an argument over tax rates, the reason to lower or raise taxes derives from moral arguments about the human person and property. Even arguments about parking tickets are ultimately moral arguments. And so you have to legislate morality. And the great coup that has been achieved, I think, by the secular left in recent years is they've convinced everybody, even many conservatives, that secular liberalism is neutral. That's the neutral playing field. That's what the Founding Fathers wanted. And of course, it's not. The Founding Fathers never wanted anything of the kind. John Adams pointed out that unless society were moral and religious, the Constitution would fall apart. The founders of our country supported religious institutions, and even the more theologically eccentric of them had great respect and even practice for these kind of religious institutions. So I just think you're going to end up in a crazy society if you don't take these questions back to first principles. And it's one of the great insights of Edmund Burke, the kind of early modern conservative philosopher, who said, the age of chivalry is gone, that of sophisters, economists, and calculators has succeeded it, and the glory of Europe is extinguished forever. He said we shouldn't just focus on economics or bean counting, that's sort of silly. That's not a real politics. We have to talk about what really matters. Those eternal questions that will shape our cultural views and our religious views.
Michael, I have a follow-up question with that, because you have a massive platform. You are an outspoken Catholic. Your faith means a tremendous amount to you. And you and I both know that real change truly does begin in the heart. So in the midst of being, you know, knee-deep in politics, what's your philosophy with a platform that you have to really change the heart and the mind and not just focus on the politics?
One thing that I've tried to do, sometimes unsuccessfully, is not to lose my temper. You know, there's a popular genre of political debate on both sides of the aisle, which is, you know, that you're going to smack down or destroy or totally stomp somebody in a political debate. And it's fun to do, and there is a place for it as well. If you're in a sort of performative debate with some big left-wing talking head, for instance, then the purpose of that public debate is not to convince, but it is merely to destroy. And then people can judge for themselves who made the better argument. But in most political debate, and most interview, certainly the interviews I like to conduct, I don't find that to be very productive. I really want to guide people and try to understand what they're thinking and then ask some questions and maybe expose some flaws in their thinking. Because we do have to remember, even though politics matters immensely, and I think politics matters a lot more than many Catholics are willing to admit, you know, we have a role in the culture. We have a role in politics and government. We can't merely wait around for the next world. We have things to do in this world as well. But beyond that, we are called to charity. We're called to courage, sure. We're called to prudence, sure. And we're called to charity. And so if you're in a political debate and all you're interested in doing is absolutely tearing down your fellow American, you know, that's going to be a Pyrrhic victory, because if you tear down half the country rather than merely tearing down their ideas, well, then half your country's gone.
Michael, it's fascinating that you bring that up about kind of keeping calm and really respecting the other person essentially in that argument, rather than maybe falling into the mocking and the name calling and just the outright foul language that can often occur on both sides of the spectrum when it comes to political, even moral conversation debate. But this reminds me of what I wanted to get to, and that is maintaining friendships in the face of a culture of compelled speech and censorship. You speak of remaining calm, in that kind of helps you to wear your faith really on your sleeve in many ways and to change hearts and minds because of how you conduct yourself. But do you think it's possible to have good friendships with people who disagree when we feel so compelled to throw up that blackout or the Black Lives Matter post, or when we're feeling censored by those exact people that are so-called our friends or family?
The trouble with war is that your opponent gets a say. So when some people say, well, war is not the answer, we have no place for war, and that's a very naive point of view, because your opponent has a say in that, and even if you say that I'm not going to engage in war, your opponent can. And the same is true in friendship. I do not let politics get in the way of my friendships. I have wonderful friendships with people who are not only liberal, you know, kind of squishy liberals, but full-on hardcore left-wingers. And unfortunately, a lot of left-wingers are not willing to do that to conservatives. You see this borne out in social scientific data. When you look just on social media, left-wingers are much more likely to unfriend conservatives than vice versa.
Right.
You hear this all the time. Every Thanksgiving, there's some stupid article published in a left-wing magazine talking about how you should best scold your Republican uncle at the turkey table. Just absolutely preposterous. And in that case, you do have to be willing to let your friend or former friend walk away. You know, you shouldn't become a pushover. You shouldn't lie about your views. You shouldn't try to change your own views just because you want to go along to get along with some intransigent friend who doesn't respect your own mind and your own faculties of reason. And that's a very sad thing, because you see friendships dissolve along those lines. But this is a sad world, and sometimes you've got to deal with a little bit of suffering in that way.
But that's the exact challenge. I think so many people are terrified of being themselves, of saying what they think about faith, politics, you know, religion, anything, that it's actually worn tremendously on relationships that people just, I almost would say, aren't even developing relationships anymore because they're on pins and needles, afraid to say a thing that could offend someone else.
True. I think there's been a great degradation of friendship. And actually, part of it plays into the sexual revolution. I was actually speaking about this with a very smart friend of mine who has same-sex attraction. And I said, you know, something that's really destroyed friendship is now everything's gay. And he laughed, and he knew exactly what I was talking about, which is now two people of the same sex are not permitted to have a deep, profound relationship without it being suspected of being sexual. And he said, oh, no, it's absolutely right, you know, and I say this as a gay guy, but everything's become too gay. And what he meant is that you can, obviously there are sexual relationships, there are familial relationships, and there were at least at one time friend relationships where it's been described as two people standing next to one another looking at the same thing. Maybe from a slightly different perspective, and you can talk about that, and you can debate about that. And it's not about trying to destroy or smack, and it's not about staring one at the other person. You're really looking at the outside world, and you are developing your own views of what that means. And I've been privileged to have some really wonderful friendships in my life, but they're not based around, you know, going along to get along, and they're not based around just talking about how great the chicken tastes. They're really based upon trying to delve the depths of what it means to be human, what our lives really mean, what we're striving for. And those friendships do tend to take on a spiritual dimension. And in this culture, it's very hard even to understand what that kind of friendship is. But I think we ought to strive for that. And if we have to lose a few of these accidental friendships along the way, these shallow friendships, so be it. It's not a great loss.
I think this is one of the challenges that many people of faith have, and I think this is the importance of exposure. I know you come from the acting, arts, theater world. I come from the dancing world, and so we've been exposed to a lot of people who radically disagree with the way we live or the things we think or say about politics and religion. Yet at the same time, because we've had those deep encounters, we've had, you know, those opportunities to stand by side, as you said, perhaps it's allowed us to have that exposure, to have more respect for the individual person rather than furthering the chasm between the two.
Of course, and our Lord puts it very well, as you would expect that he might, when he says that if you are not prepared to hate your father, hate your mother, hate your brother and sister, to follow him, then you are not prepared for him. You are not prepared for salvation. This is not a call to go be mean to your parents, but it's a call to put God first and to put that relationship first. Talk about a true friendship. Greater love has no man than to give his life for his friends. And when you put friendship and all human relationship as subsidiary to that relationship that you have with God, everything falls into place, all the very, even the trivial relationships that you have. But when you try to flip that and you say that, you know, my relationship with Johnny from work, who doesn't like that I voted for Trump or something, that's the first thing, and I've got to change all my views. When you do that, you totally flip it around, and it will degrade all of your other relationships as well.
Wow, Michael, we have breaking news here. Justice Ginsburg has just died. United States Supreme Court has just confirmed it. Michael, I'm gathering details as we speak, but what will be the first steps with the death of a Supreme Court justice and an election right around the corner?
Well, the first thing we can do, I suppose, is pray for Justice Ginsburg's soul. She very famously had a long friendship on this topic we're discussing with Antonin Scalia, and I'm sure that Nino Scalia is enjoying his eternal reward. And so we can only hope and pray that Justice Ginsburg gets to see her old pal up there as well. I suspect that people in Washington had a feeling that this was coming. I suspect there's been a lot of chatter. You know that the president released his shortlist or expanded his shortlist for the Supreme Court just about a week ago. I suspect that was not coincidental. People have known for a long time that Justice Ginsburg was ill. I think she's fought off just about every type of cancer, and she was mature in age. So now this is sort of out of a Hollywood movie, I suspect, this 2020 election, because there was only one thing that could throw this election into even more chaos, and that was the death of Justice Ginsburg. And after the COVID, after the lockdowns, after the mail-in voting, after the economic collapse, that was the last straw we could have had. And of course, it seems to have happened. And the constitutional crisis that I feel we were already heading into, because we know that the Democrats, led by Hillary Clinton and others, were going to dispute the results of the election regardless. Hillary Clinton said that Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances. We've now read in newspapers that there will be a red mirage on election night. Trump will win, but they will litigate it through the end and try to effectively steal it, I think, in the courts. That is now going to be turned up to 11, to use the language of the movie Spinal Tap. That is now going to go to... Yeah, I think that this will basically be, after 4 or 5 months of riots burning in the streets, this puts us in a very precarious situation.
No wonder you're leaving for Nashville, Michael. Oh my gosh.
This would tip it over the edge.
This is huge. This will tip it over the edge. I mean, this is our opportunity to react as people of faith. If you're just joining us, the United States Supreme Court has confirmed that there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died as of this afternoon, and President Donald Trump could try to fill that space. We're already talking about this civil unrest, people leaving Los Angeles, people leaving California, people still staying home, not only because of COVID, but because of rioting. And Michael, I can't help but think this is our moment as people of faith to be full of hope, to be full of joy, of peace. Because if we dive in headlong into this debate, into this argument, no matter which side of the political spectrum we are on, it could be more damaging for the culture than it could be good.
It certainly could. And on a practical matter now, people are going to ask whether or not they can confirm the justice. Well, as of right now, they probably could not because of the filibuster, because you need more than a simple majority to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. But the filibuster has been chipped away at for a long time. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, famously got rid of it for most. That is going to now raise a question of whether or not they should kill the filibuster for the Supreme Court nominees. I think they should. I don't think they're going to get brownie points for any sort of politeness here. I think that the Democrats will certainly do it if they get the opportunity. So they should kill the filibuster. They should push through a Supreme Court nominee. The Democrats are going to cry foul because Mitch McConnell would not let Merrick Garland, Obama's nominee, go through in 2016. Right. But that's a preposterous argument. It was always a power play in politics. Joe Biden himself actually said all those years back in the early 1990s that the president has every right to push through a Supreme Court nominee in an election year. And I think that's absolutely what the Republicans should do. And I look forward to hearing who Trump's nominee is.
Okay, that's what they should do. Last question here. What do you think will happen?
I think that Mitch McConnell is one of the greatest operators of the mechanisms of power in Senate history. And I think President Trump has more political courage, and don't forget, courage is a virtue, than many of his Republican predecessors, presidents and presidential nominees. So if I were a betting man, there are arguments against it, but if I were a betting man, I think they will put forward a nominee.
That's Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire. You can hear him soon from Nashville on his show, The Michael Knowles Show. Thank you for being with us, Michael. We'll be right back here on Trending with Timmery.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
I think people are in shock right now. There's a vacancy on the Supreme Court. It's been confirmed. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died at the age of 87, battling cancer. I'm sure more details will come. It's something that people have been holding out to see what would happen. What will happen to the Supreme Court? What will happen to the election? What will happen in terms of who chooses who the next Supreme Court justice will be before or after the election? And we pray for mercy on this nation as there may be an increase in public uprising and rioting. And so we pray for peace. This is why we have this 54-day novena being prayed here with Relevant Radio, ending right around the same time of the election. This is why we are people of faith. This is why our hope is in God our Father and not in any political leader, not in any Supreme Court justice, not in any opinion or guess that we might have about what will happen in the coming months. We're reacting to this live. I mean, this is just happening. I found out as we were on the phone here with Michael Knowles just a few minutes ago. And I have to tell you, I'll be really honest. Not that this is the way I wanted to end a Friday, but I'm concerned about how our nation will handle this. I'm concerned about how you and I will be beacons of hope and faith in the face of an unthinkable political atmosphere, in the face of what has already been a culture that has been rioting and burning and destroying things. We need to have hope. We need to let go of, you know, the fact that things will be great if this person wins the election or that person wins the election. We need to remember that no matter what happens, whether we see the next 2 months of political unrest, whether we see our candidate lose, whether we see someone we know will not be pro-life on that Supreme Court by the end of the year or next year, that we know that our hope and our faith is in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that, yes, we can cast our vote, but this is a reminder why voting matters. We've talked about it last election, and we're talking about it again today. This has had to do with Supreme Court justices. It was the Supreme Court who decided the case of Roe versus Wade. It was the Supreme Court who decided the case to rule out that multiple states, both in the case of abortion and in the case of same-sex marriage, had already voted. Marriage is between one man and one woman, and they wrote it into their constitution. State after state after state after state, even California, voted to keep marriage between one man and one woman. And yet the Supreme Court overruled the votes of the society. How is it that suddenly political opinion, individual opinions have changed so rapidly on same-sex marriage because these same people voted in their own states? It's because we believe that what is legal is moral. That's a slippery slope. Do you believe that what is legal is moral? It's funny, I was with some family last night, and my husband was making the joke about me being a little bit of a rule breaker. And my first reaction to him saying that was, well, I thought of laws, about good laws versus bad laws, and how just because there's a rule doesn't mean it's right. That doesn't mean I can't be obedient to the rule, but there are also times to stand up and say no, to stand up in the face of being civilly disobedient in a culture with respect, with reverence, because life matters. This is why the Supreme Court matters in this upcoming election. This is why who you vote for matters. And again, I started by saying that we can't put all our eggs in one basket. We can't just say, you know, whoever is the president, whoever is in office, whoever is the next Supreme Court justice will be our hope. No, we have to work as if everything, yes, sure, depended on us, but we have to have faith and hope that our Lord Jesus Christ has a plan and that he can bring great hope and glory and love and joy and transformation out of anything. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday, and we didn't get to it, but we will on Monday. What are we having, a baby boy or a baby girl? Stay tuned. I will tell you, I promise, on Monday.
Day 11, Mother Inviolate, pray for us. Inviolate is spelled I-N-V-I-O-L-A-T-E and means free from injury or violation. It is not to be confused with the word violet or the color purple. Just as sunlight passes through a window without breaking the glass, the Blessed Mother remained a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus Christ. That's what inviolate means. Indeed, the birth of Jesus was a miraculous birth. The early fathers of the church were nearly unanimous in this teaching. St. Ambrose, St. Augustine, St. John Chrysostom, St. Leo the Great, and St. Gregory the Great. This title references the second Marian dogma of perpetual virginity. Mary was a virgin before, during, and after birth. If you believe that, I'll tell you another one. That a man can take some breath, say some words, and change it into God. But he can if he's a priest. Yes, we have some extraordinary beliefs in our Catholic faith. Still, they're all true. Mother Inviolate, pray for the church and our nation.